Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
Listen, Nerd Right Radio!
Nerd Alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 21 of Nerd Pride Radio. 21, it's a Fibonacci number, a Harshad number, a Motzkin number, a triangular number, an octagonal number, and, according to Dr. Duncan McDougall, 21 grams is also the weight of the human soul. So ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, science nerd, a gaming nerd, and plus, there's about seven other kinds of nerd that I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place where I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. As always, you're listening to the best-smelling podcast on the internet. That's right, Nerd Pride Radio smells like an autumn sunset in the Shire. By the way, Dr. Duncan McDougall, complete and total quack. Dude, actually, he's a Scottish physician, 1901-ish, maybe. He wound up going to an old folks' home, and anytime there was someone who was on death's door, he'd rig up their bed onto a giant scale, and he would weigh them to the gram every second, and he would track their weights, and then at the moment of death, boom, he would see, look, on average, they lost about 21 grams at the moment of death. That must be their soul departing the body. Of course, he also did the exact same experiment on sheep, and as it turns out, sheep, according to Dr. McDougall, actually gain weight at the moment of death temporarily, and then they lose it again later. The only thing that they could figure for that is there must be a portal to heaven that opens up before they then finally go. Any animal that didn't change weight when it died must not have a soul. Dogs apparently have no soul. But time is a-wasting. We're actually going to go directly to the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting, I add it to my master list, and the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So, straight into the master list. This is actually a brand new segment entitled Pegacorns Revealed. Started this in honor of one of our listeners, Rossus Pegacorn, who's written in a couple of times. And Rossus Pegacorn has asked me what problem I have with Pegacorns. And so therefore, I've just decided to create this entirely new segment devoted to why I hate Pegacorns. This all stems from a thread on the forums where I asked the question, why do you hate Pegacorns? And I opened up with myself because Pegacorns ate my baby. And we had wonderful examples from all sorts of people. I'm going to read just a few. One of them, first one. This one's from me, actually. I pointed out that, you know, I hate Pegacorns because they're terrible drivers. Just the other day, we were headed to a tournament for one of our kids, and this guy in front of us is just wandering back and forth across the road. His tires constantly drifting into the next lane, and you could see the dude was totally talking on his cell phone. He's one of those guys that slows down when there's traffic or when the road gets twisty, and so as long as there's no way to pass him, oh, he's doing 50 miles an hour, but as soon as the road's clear, boom, he's back up to 65. Friggin' jerk. And I called it. I called it, too. I looked at my wife, and I said, you know what? I'll lay you money that jerk's a Pegacorn. Wouldn't you know it? 20 minutes later, I finally get a chance to pass him. Sure enough, it's a Pegacorn. And he's staring at me like I'm the one with the problem. Jerk. That was my sample. All right. But I'm not the only one that hates Pegacorns. This one comes from Kyle on the forums. And Kyle says, I was super psyched about an eBay auction. It was the original Joust with the cabinet and all the original display art. The seller was in Austin, so I wouldn't even have to pay shipping. I was the only bidder at $175 until 2 minutes before the auction ended, and Pega Horndog 69 swooped in and bought the whole thing for $207.30, a penny over my maximum bid. I contacted him by email after the auction was over, maybe to see if I could give him a few bucks to stay out of the auction, and here was his response. Quote, no way, baby. I hate that game. Jousting from an ostrich? Why don't you just spit in a Pegacorn's face? I'm not even having it shipped to me. I'm just paying two Mexican day laborers to pick it up and take it to the landfill. That's what that game deserves, end quote. Kyle continues, it was crazy, stupid Pegacorn. I like that one. But I think my absolute favorite comes from one of the guys on our boards, Crazy Elf. Crazy Elf says, I hate it when I'm in the 10 items or less aisle at the supermarket and the guy in front of me is a Pegacorn. That's my best. So, I don't know if we'll ever do this segment again, but there's lots of reasons to hate Pegacorns. So as they come up, you guys send them in. I will certainly bring them to the show. Next up, though, it's another brand new segment. This one's called The Cheese Culture Report.
I thought this was
cheese
for weirdos.
Wow, Gonzo, that's actually pretty dead on. I was actually going to use some Wallace and Gromit sound effects because they do a lot of discussion about cheese. But for some reason, every clip I tried to record of Wallace and Gromit came out sounding like crap. So next time I do a cheese culture report, I may change up that music. But for now, Gonzo was kind enough to help us fill in. All right, you guys know I want to be a cheese nerd. That this starts my entire cheese nerd project, and I have been working on about once a week, I buy myself a new cheese. And I try it out, and I've been on the forums reporting back to what I've been finding. I've mentioned this a couple times. And I love this. I'm having so much fun. And every cheese that I get, I have to go out online. I do some research on the cheese, find out, you know, what I should be expecting from it or you know, its origins. For example, I didn't even know Gouda was a Dutch cheese. Here I go rambling on and on about how much I love the Dutch on this show. Turns out my favorite cheese so far, Gouda, Dutch, should have known. All right, so here's the deal. Up till now, I love smoked Gouda, I love Munster, and I found out I hate goat milk cheese. You know what? I tried it. It was a little tangy, a little tart, and turns out all goat milk cheese is pretty much that way because the proteins in it cause a higher concentration of acid, give it that acidic citrus tart flavor. I don't care for that. I mean, you know, here I was being all brave because, you know, goat cheese. If you told me to try goat cheese, if I wasn't doing it for this project, if someone said, hey, do you want to try some goat cheese? To me, it's almost the equivalent of someone saying, hey, you guys want to try this spoiled milk I found in the fridge? I don't know how long it's been here. That, to me, that's the association I make in my head. But I'm like, you know what? I'm doing this for science. I'm doing this for nerddom everywhere. I'll give it a shot. And so I try the goat cheese, and yeah, it turns out, you know what? I gave it a good review because I was trying to be generous, and I thought, oh, you know, it's interesting. That's decent. But that was just the first time. And then the second time I had it, it was like, eh, that was not so great. And then the third time, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to throw this out. I'm not looking forward to the snack, so why should I do it? The cheese nerd project is all about me loving cheese. And if I'm not going to love it, okay, I gave it a shot. You know, we'll move on to the next one. But here is my triumph this week, and if you can find this in your store anywhere, I just found this at my local Hy-Vee grocery store. This isn't even, it's not even anything fancy. It's just right there on the local grocer shelf. I didn't have to go to a specialty store or nothing. And it is Saxonshire cheese. And now, because it's a British cheese, and I see Saxonshire, it's two separate words, so I'm pronouncing it like that. For all I know, if it had been one word, I'd be saying Saxonshire. But I'm going to go with Saxonshire. It's by a company called Coombs Castle in Britain, and it's imported. And this cheese, it's a five-county cheese. So they take five counties in England famous for their cheese, and they put all five of those cheeses in layers together and make a single big wheel. And then what I bought was a little half-pound wedge of that. And so, therefore, the layers of this cheese are cheddar, Derby, double Gloucester, Red Leicester, and Lancashire. Five cheeses, four of which I've never tried before. I mean, seriously, a $6 wedge of cheese and I get to try four new cheeses all at once? I was so excited. Now, it turns out, I'm guessing it has something to do with import laws. The Derby, for some reason, does not come in the American version of Saxonshire cheese. Apparently only in the British version. So I don't know. I didn't do enough research on Derby. I don't know if it's made with raw milk or something that there's a restriction on. So instead, I get actually two different flavors of cheddar. I get a white cheddar and a colored cheddar, which to me tasted almost identical. So the white cheddar was a little bit milder maybe. But anyway, but the other three, and these were, by the way, really good cheddars. I was thrilled to death with them. I liked them better than that aged cheddar that I bought a few weeks ago. But all right, getting to try the double Gloucester, the red Leicester, and the Lancashire was just a treat. I was so excited. Double Gloucester tastes a lot like cheddar. All right. If I had not had the cheddar there with it, I would have just assumed it was just a type of cheddar. All right. But then I tried them side by side, and I go back and forth a little bit. And the Gloucester it's a little tangier, a little sharper, but really good cheese. But for me, the real treat here was the Lancashire and the Red Leicester. The Lancashire, both of them are very similar. They're very crumbly as far as a firm cheese goes. So they're a little crumbly in texture. But they've got some kind of sharp, cheddary taste, but there's a nutty flavor underneath it that just, especially with the Red Leicester, I don't know what happened. Every time I take a little bite of that, the first bite of it, I feel like I've had it before. It reminds me of some treat that I had when I was a kid. I mean, it takes me back, and I have this vision of being 7 or 8 years old, and I'm eating, and I don't know what. I don't know what it is, but I get the same vision, this memory impression from eating the Red Leicester. And so there's something about it that just takes me back, and I wish I could identify it because it's driving me mad, but I really like it. Red Leicester has just now, I think, surpassed the Gouda and the Munster to become my favorite cheese. I love that. I love that about it. So I would like to find, not in this whole, you know, Saxonshire thing, but I'd love to have just a chunk of Red Leicester just to really, really be able to try it out and savor it. I mean, the bits I'm getting are good, but it's just such a tiny bit every day. So I'm working on that. So I don't know where I'm going to go with my next one. I think I'm going to go back to some Dutch cheese, maybe try some Edam next time, but we'll see. Anyway, as I try more cheeses, I will try and come back with more cheese culture reports. And I don't think I'll spend quite so much time on them every time because, you know, how many of you are really that excited about hearing about cheese? I know I am, but today it's the first segment and there were three new cheeses. I'm so happy. So more of that later, because now it's time for the Science Corner.
Oh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
And Bill Shatner's dulcet tones means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. All right. We have a new user. In fact, the newest user on our forums is a Mark CMG. And Mark CMG is obviously a fan of the podcast. He liked us on Facebook. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate that. And the CMG stands for Creative Mountain Games. I followed his link back, and I checked out his own blog. And while the gaming stuff is interesting, the first thing I noticed at creativemountaingames.com is a link to the 100-year Starship project, which I've never heard of before. So therefore, I wound up clicking links forever, and I'm just fascinated by this. It's an actual government-funded project to research the viability of a 100-year Starship project, exactly as the name entails. Holy crap! Are you serious? All right. Right now, they've just awarded the first $500,000 grant. This is the first half of the money, and it's going to Mae Jemison's foundation, the Jemison something or other. I don't actually write down any of my notes, so I'm just going from memory on this. But Mae Jemison was the first black woman in space, 1992, and since then has done lots of work towards education and space exploration kinds of stuff, and just very fascinating career this woman's had. And so her foundation, her organization, is going to be heading up the 100-year Starship project. And now, sadly, one of the first disappointing aspects of this is, okay, we're only talking about grand total $1 million being invested, and even though it's called the 100-year Starship Project, it is actually a one-year project to study, hey, what would we have to do if we wanted a real 100-year project? So this is, you know, baby steps. It's just a toe in the water, obviously. But, you know, they've gone so far as they're looking at, you know, all right, what kind of ship are we going to need? How are we going to handle multi-generational projects like this? You know, ensure that we continue to have support for the 100 years or more it might take, not to mention the fact that if we ever get to the stage of sending people out, how do we handle multiple generations on a ship? You know, how do you handle families and relationships and children? How does that work on a starship? What do you do with this? You know, where are we going to go? This is all fascinating to me. Now, first off, what kind of ship are we going to use? It's going to probably ultimately be some sort of fusion-powered ship. At least in part, it's going to have to be fusion-powered. How are we going to keep people from dying out there? And they've got all sorts of interesting things for particle and radiation shielding that goes around it. Where are we going to go? This is my favorite part. Where are we going to go? Probably Alpha Centauri. Just because it's the closest damn thing to us. I mean, honestly. And now, then one of the researchers was talking about, look, we want to go somewhere where there are planets. We want to go somewhere where there's a planetary system. There's going to be resources. You know, if we can actually land on a planet, awesome, or get close enough to study one or whatever. But we want to make sure there's some kind of planetary system and possibly with planets that could eventually support human life. And he says, you know what? Alpha Centauri is the closest to us. It is our first choice in all things just because of its proximity. And he said, you know what? By the time we get to actually launching something, we'll know if Alpha Centauri has the right kind of planets. I mean, we will know. Look at how far we've gone in leaps and bounds in our knowledge of extrasolar planets. I mean, I've already talked about it on this podcast. I love extrasolar planets. And he's saying, you know, by that time, our knowledge of these things will be fine enough that we will know exactly what we're going to get to, exactly what we can look forward to or what kinds of things we can expect. And so therefore, he says, hopefully Alpha Centauri, unless it doesn't have the right kind of planets, in which case, all right, we'll pick the next closest one, maybe something 6 light years away, 7 light years away. But all told, we're talking about, they call it the 100-year project because, you know, even if we can manage building the ship and we can manage the fusion power and we can manage to get this puppy up to, you know, 15% of the speed of light is their very ambitious goal for this, we're talking about, you know, something like if we went to Alpha Centauri, you know, maybe grand total a 60-year round trip to get to Alpha Centauri and back. And if we're looking at, you know, something a little further away because maybe Centauri doesn't meet our needs, then, yeah, maybe an 80-year trip, maybe a 90-year trip. And they want to do, clearly, they want to do robots first. They want to send out an unmanned ship that can go out and just prove that this is viable. We can learn from it, figure out what we're going to do for a manned trip after that. So we're talking about having an unmanned ship go out and possibly back, but at least out, and then maybe 60, 80, 100 years from now, we'll know if it's possible to send people. But you know what? That's maybe about the right time frame. I mean, if we're looking at sending people out in 100 years, 150 years, then yeah, right now is the time we need to start with sending out, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, launching our first extrasolar ship. I'm thrilled to death about this. I think this is awesome. And to me, I don't want to go off on more tangents than I already do, but the idea of what does it take in an artificial intelligence to run this trip for us? Because once it gets, you know, beyond this solar system, in fact, even before then, we're beyond the point where we can reasonably hope to control this ship on our own. I mean, it can send us back information, but, you know, quickly, as soon as it's out of the solar system, we're talking, you know, days before we can get information exchanged. And by the time it gets where it's going, years in a round-trip transmission. So we're talking about a ship that has to be, once it leaves this solar system, has to be completely autonomous. So it gets to Alpha Centauri or wherever it's going, and we know about where all of its planets are going to be. We'll know what it should expect when it gets there, but it's not going to see all the comets and all the asteroids and all the other little things that are there. It may even, you know, we won't even see all the planets. We'll know the biggest ones, maybe the Earth-sized ones. There may be some other stuff in there in between that this thing's going to have to get there. It's going to have to account for that stuff. It's going to have to be able to navigate itself through a solar system and put itself in orbit around something so that we can actually learn and study and put itself in orbit around something, possibly land or send down a lander. I mean, it'll probably have probes for just this sort of purpose. And it'll have to make all those decisions on its own. It'll have to get out there and hang out and probably, I would guess, going to hang out in orbit for at least, you know, the 10 years it takes that, you know, for it to send stuff to us. And then we finally can send a command back. And so after it's been in orbit for 10 years, 15 years, finally it has its instructions and decides, okay, we'll move to another planet, or okay, we'll head back home, or whatever it's going to do. Although I doubt we'll plan a two-way trip for the robots. Robots are expendable ultimately, at least until they become sentient. So, okay. Anyway, I could go on and on and on about this stuff, but I love the idea of the 100-year Starship project. I understand it's cloud talk. It's pie in the sky. It's but we got to start somewhere, right? And so, Mae Jemison, Godspeed to you. Seriously, more power to you. I hope you can produce some results that inspire someone else to keep moving on this, because I would love to know that this is where humanity is going. This is it's heartwarming and inspiring. We need this. Holy crap, can you believe we have yet another new segment? Hang on, listen.
Don't know much about history.
That's right. And now it's time for the Unnamed History segment. I don't have a title for this one yet. If you guys think of one, send it to me. I'll rename it in a heartbeat. This is our history segment, and this last week I ran across Ching Shi. Who is Ching Shi? If you already know, you are cooler than crap. I commend you. Ching Shi is a Chinese pirate, or was a Chinese pirate, and even better, a woman. Probably the most powerful female pirate ever to roam the earth. All right, Ching Shi starts off her life. We have no idea exactly when she was born, or where she was born, or even what her real name is. We have no clue of any name before she became Ching Shi. And we do know that she was a prostitute in the floating brothels of Canton in China. All right. Starts as a prostitute, is kidnapped by pirates. Not an uncommon occurrence if you're going to be living in a floating brothel. And I don't know how long she was in pirate captivity or sailing with pirates or however it works out, but in 1801, Ching Shi, this woman, marries Zhang Yi. Zhang Yi was one of the most powerful pirate captains at the time, all right? Or he was becoming that. And Zhang Yi had a fleet of pirate ships, all right? Thousands of men at his command. And he marries Ching Shi. Ching Shi, by the way, simply means widow of Zhang. So she is named for her dead husband, because once he was dead, she takes over. And so, literally, she's the widow Zhang. That's all she's known by. And she was bad frickin' ass. Holy crap. All right. While married to Zhang Yi, the two of them together built up the pirate fleet until, at the time of Zhang Yi's death, he dies in 1807. All right. 6 years later, they get up to 1,600 ships at their command. 1,600. That is no lie. That is 80,000 men, women, and children under their command. That's a nation. I mean, that's. You didn't sail the waters of China without their say-so. They were terrors, holy terrors on the high seas. Not kidding at all, all right? And so at the time that he dies, there's some political infighting, but apparently she had been his partner, and she was influential enough that she took over. It was hers. So now she rules all by herself, all right? Almost 2,000 ships, almost 100,000 people, this huge, enormous army of pirates. This is no lie. That's why in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, do you remember the Chinese female pirate in the Caribbean movies? Do you remember her when they get to the Council of Pirates and she was all powerful and badass and stuff? All right, that's her. That was based her. It was supposed to be Ching Shi. That was who that was in the movie. And as it turns out, Ching Shi in real life, that we only have the one photo or whatever it is. I don't know that it's a photo, it's a tintype, whatever the thing is. But it's a picture of her in her full pirate getup holding a sword. And for her day, she's not a bad looking gal. I mean, at the height of her power, she would have been 30, maybe 35. All right. And so she was absolutely the thing that romantic pirate novels are made of. I mean, that. And when I say romantic, I don't mean in the sense of love and romance. I mean as in romance and adventure. And she was just built for this. I mean, you know, young, good-looking, and incredibly smart, incredibly capable and talented, and standing there looking like a badass pirate with a sword. That's how cool it was, all right? And so Ching Shi operates for 3 years. This is the length of her reign. Now, why only three? Did she get killed? No. No, she was such an unholy terror, right? I mean, and she was strict. She ruled with an iron hand, all right? You stole from her, you were put to death, all right? For a lot of other infractions, we just cut off your hands. If you were anyone under her command who was found out to be a rapist, put to death immediately. She did not tolerate rape, subjugation of women in any way. Just fascinating. And now, and of course, a lot of this may be confounded with myth because, all right, you think we make heroes out of our past criminals? I mean, Robin Hood or Billy the Kid or Jesse James. Do we, Bonnie and Clyde, do we romanticize them in our literature? Hell yes, we do. You think the Chinese are any different? No, no. Because her myth, I mean, this is, again, a woman who's passed before she married Zheng Yi. We know nothing about her at all. All right. All we know is this 15-year window of her life. Well, and then I'll get to her retirement in a minute. And she is made out to be a hero in Japan. She is this romantic anti-hero, and or in, not Japan, China. And just the way we do with our past criminals, they've done the same thing there. So some of the things I'm listing as fact, I mean, we know that she led a huge fleet and that she had to, but no, did she really put all rapists to death? That seems to be listed as fact in a lot of places. I don't know. I haven't done the research to confirm every bit of this. Doesn't matter. If it's not true, it needs to be. So I'll just repeat it here. But then, 1810, the reason that her career ends there is because the government offered her a truce. They offered her amnesty, her and her adopted son, who was also kidnapped by pirates at the age of 15, was then adopted by Zheng Yi and Qing Shi, and some sources say that she even married her adopted son after they retired from piracy. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, the government offered amnesty to several of the major pirate captains out there, and Qing Shi said, yeah, okay, sure. And she was allowed to retire from piracy. No charges were pressed whatsoever. She got to keep the money. She kept every bit of it. All right, she retired a rich, rich woman. Holy crap. I mean, and, you know, she wound up opening other ventures and doing other things, but she retired a very comfortable woman. Her adopted son became, not only did he retire and get to keep his money, but he also took a post in the Chinese Navy, and he retired a colonel in the Chinese Navy. He became, they were respected. He became an honorable man. All right, from his pirate roots. This from a kidnapped teenager who becomes a pirate king who then retires a Navy colonel. This is a great story. This is no wonder the Chinese keep making this over and over and over. I would too. You think we got a lot of versions of Robin Hood? They got a lot of versions of Qing Shi. So that is our first history segment. Hope you liked it. And without any further ado, it is time to visit my gaming table.
I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die.
That's right. Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, I'm going to share it with you. And this week, I have to talk about Instant Game. I've mentioned Instant Game before. You'll hear me talk about it again. I am so loving my Instant Game. This is a game that my brother and I wrote many, many years ago, and we published on our old Animal Ball website, and I've carried it over to Nerd Pride Radio. If you go to our main page and you look, click the free games link, Instant Game is the very first thing that appears on that page. It is for free. Take it, use it, have fun with it. We encourage that. I love Instant Game, and I want to share it with you. But more than that, I've been thinking about Instant Game a lot, and it needs a little upgrade. It needs some more variety. It needs some new stuff. And so I'm slowly starting on the forums, and I'll keep adding more, but looking for input from people to add new terms and new things that we can do with Instant Game because I love it, and I want to make it better. I want to pump it up. I want to hand it out again. I'm not looking to make money off of it, at least not at this point. But if anyone wants to offer me a lot of money for Instant Game, I am open to suggestions. Okay. Instant Game, as I've explained before, is a set of tables that allow you to come to a gaming table with a game master and however many players you want, and then you roll on these tables, and it will give you the tone of your game, it will give you the setting you're going to use, elements to put into it, and it takes some thinking. You got to use your brain on this one, but honest to God, when we've done it, and we've done it a dozen times, you sit down at the table, and from zero to full game, ready to run, 30 to 45 minutes, and you're ready to go. And I was inspired to revisit it because of all this Method 1 character creation talk where you roll your dice and you assign the the abilities to your character, and you wind up having a bunch of difficult situations, and you have to puzzle through them and figure out how to make a good character out of all of that. Well, that reminded me so much of working instant game that I had to pull the stuff back out. And so I've even done a couple of samples on the forums where I will just throw out a sample set of instant game roles, and whatever comes up on the tables, I will just post it up on the forums and say, okay, here's our setting roles, here's our plot roles, here's our other stuff. Make a setting out of this. Go. All right. And then everyone, without looking at anyone else's answers, supposedly, we all create our own settings. And then afterwards, you go back and you review and you compare notes and go, okay, from the same set of dice rolls, how many different worlds did we get? And how different are they? And how cool are they? And by the way, they're all cool. There's not a bad one in the bunch. Go look. Go read those threads. Every single one of them is completely playable. For example, the first one of these I rolled up, it was like a mystery or intrigue or something like that, setting on the Wild West, and it involved heaven and hell and undead, okay? Those are our main elements, and there's some other stuff that comes for the plot and other things like that with some kind of infestation or prophecy or something. Anyway, these are the roles as we get them. And so we wound up with my personal one that I did for me. I did a setting where, for some reason, I set it in a little town in Canada on the Pacific coast back in 1843. It was a Wild West gold mining town built by the gold rush there. And I wound up managing to have heaven and hell, angels and demons, are able to get back to Earth, but only through the discarded bodies of humans who have died. And so they're bringing these bodies back. And the whole thing winds up being this political intrigue. I hit Wikipedia for a while and did a bunch of research on this. It's an actual town called New Westminster in Canada. Would have been the capital there until Vancouver moved in. But anyway, that's beside the point. So I had all this research on, you know, the political figures of the time and the different peoples. There was, you know, Chinese immigrants and American Indians and, you know, the Anglos and the French and the Americans and pirates and just opium trade, all sorts of great stuff thrown in. And then on top of this, you have reanimated bodies of the dead being powered by angels and demons who are fighting each other. And I had a great time. And I mean, I'd play it. I created it. I would love to play in a game like that. The thing was awesome. Eliahad took it differently. He put his Wild West setting on an alien planet where an ark ship has crashed and there are already natives there, and it's how they interpret the people who are coming down from heaven, according to them, and just fascinating stuff. Yeah, Stans involved awesome time travel stuff, and the best part about Stans is it's all right, you're time fixers. You're going back to the past to fix things that have gone wrong, but he opens his setting with Jesus died in a gunfight in 1881. That's the error that you have to go fix. And I just thought, Jesus died in a gunfight in 1881. That is the best opening line to anything ever created by mankind. I love that. Oh, and then elves, crazy elf. Just went crazy with a big long write-up of an old West town where people are being worked to death. As they work themselves to death for Satan, and as they're working, they work, they die, and then they're brought back to work again, and each time they come back, they lose a little bit more of their soul until eventually they're just walking shells. And I mean, it goes on and on. He winds up having a built-in conflict right from the start. He sets it up so that one of the party, at least one of the party, will be at odds with all the others immediately from the beginning, and it's built into the way the game's going to be run. And I was inspired. I'm like, I didn't think to do that. So, instant game, one set of roles, million different possibilities. I'm just having a good time with it. So if instant game interests you, honestly, go over to my website and check it out. Come to the forums and help me talk about it, because I'm going to be asking for some input, and I would love to have you guys there, honestly. Uh-oh, you need to get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went, "Rrr!"
That's right, it's time for some nerd rage! Okay, here's my deal. This came up just this week, and it annoys the crap out of me. It is time to stop putting hidden tracks on albums. Seriously, just stop. All right? I'm listening to AWOL Nation. I played some AWOL Nation a couple weeks ago, I don't remember. And I love AWOL Nation, I love all their music, and it was a song that I like, and then the song gets over, and now I'm listening to Dead Air. Yeah, completely dead air. So, okay, I wait, I'm like, what is going on here? So I go to look, and oh, no, it's not dead air. My iPod didn't stop. No, it's a three-minute stretch of silence at the end of their track so that they can then have a quote-unquote hidden track at the very end after the silence. Because, see, here's the thing. Especially when you're selling everything as MP3s, you can't do hidden tracks anymore because, well, I can buy the track. It's right there. It's not hidden anymore. They sell it to me with the album. So if you want to make a hidden track, well, then you have to have that silence and then the extra two-minute song is tacked onto the end so that that way, oh, you didn't know it was there. And, all right, again, this is a song I like, and I liked the little tacked-on piece at the end, and it was all cool, but you're going to make me sit there and listen to 3 minutes of silence, or you're going to make me just skip it because I'm sick and tired of not having my music, or, worse yet, make me go through the time of fast-forwarding through your silence every time this song comes up. Stop it. It's not clever, all right? It was clever when CDs first came out, and then we had, you know, bonus material, and we had hidden tracks, and we had all sorts of things that made CDs worth buying. Because, okay, for those of you who don't know, before CDs, we listened to everything on audio tape. Yeah, magnetic tape and little spools, carried it around, a little cassette. It looked like VCR tapes, for those of you who remember before DVDs. Anyway, it was a great gimmick to get people to buy CDs once upon a day. All right, but you know when the last time a hidden track was clever? Honestly? 1996, all right? That's when, on the album Factory Showroom, They Might Be Giants put a hidden track at the beginning of their album. Quite literally, if you put your CD on, your Factory Showroom CD, and you put it on and you played it beginning to end, you would never hear the hidden track. It does not come up. The only way to hear it is you put your CD on, and when the first song starts, you hit rewind. And you hold rewind until it goes back 3 minutes. And then you can hear the first hidden track. All right, and it was actually Token Back to Brooklyn is the name of that song. Which, not a great song, but okay. All right, but that was clever, right? That's the last time it actually worked, right? And that was over 15 years ago now, people. Stop, all right? There's no point to it. You're not hiding anything from us. You're not being clever. You're just annoying the crap out of me by making me listen to your silence, all right? And then, and even worse, here's the deal. Your silence in there means I'm not going to use this track for anything, all right? What could have been, because Real Big Fish did this too. You wind up having a great 5 minute song, and then you have 3 minutes of silence, and then you have a 3 minute song. All right. So if I want to include this in a playlist, if I want to put this onto a CD, if I want to do anything with it, I either have to waste that 3 minutes where I could fit a whole nother song in there. I have to either waste that 3 minutes, all right, and put the two songs together. I can't separate them. Or I need to go to the trouble of pulling out your MP3, editing it, and saving it as two separate MP3s. And I don't want to do that. You're just being a pain in my ass. Seriously. No more hidden tracks. You guys can move past that. Find something else clever that can entertain me other than your music. But for God's sake, don't do this. You see, I get too worked up. You know what would bring me down right now? A little bit of music. This week's music... You know what we haven't heard enough of around here? Bluegrass. Yeah, see, you're all excited now, aren't you? Everybody going, oh my God, bluegrass, I thought he would never get around to it. All right, this is a band called Hayseed Dixie. And Hayseed Dixie does nothing but bluegrass cover music. Specifically, they started off, their first album was a cover of AC/DC. See, get it? Hayseed Dixie, AC/DC. Okay, the cover of AC/DC songs all done in bluegrass. Is really, really good. I'm not going to play any of those. This is actually from a later album of theirs, Mountain Love, something like that. Anyway, Hayseed Dixie, this is, to start off, their cover of Centerfold.
Let's go! This wall, this town, this complete. My home angel has exploded from my seat. She is pure like snowflakes, no one could ever stain. The memory of my angel never caused me pain. Years go by, I'm looking through a girly magazine. There's my homeroom angel on the pages in between. My blood runs cold, my memory has just been sold. My angel is a centerfold, angel is a centerfold. My blood runs cold, my memory has just been sold. My angel is a circle.
and I know I'm probably alone in this, but I love bluegrass music. I don't care much for country. I mean, there's a few country songs I like. I like a wide variety of stuff, or at least I like a little bit of lots of different things. Country music, just for the most part, I just don't care for it. It usually turns me off enough that I hear it and I'm like, very rarely am I willing to give a song a chance. But bluegrass, while being a subset of country, bluegrass I love. And I especially love very fast bluegrass with a lot of variety, a lot of instrument changes. And I just enjoy the crap out of bluegrass. And so Hazy Dixie appeals to me on so many levels, giving me songs that I already know. Like I say, one of the essences of a good cover song is it's got to be a song you know, and yet they do it in a completely different style, and they make it fun, and it winds up being a good song. Even if you didn't know it was a cover, it's a good song, but once you know it's a cover, it's even better. Right? And that's what this is. I love that version of Centerfold. I own probably 4 or 5 different versions of Centerfold. That's probably my favorite. Really, really like that. You know what's back this week, though? The Word of the Week! This week's word is escalate. Right? Once again, I'm not going to make you guys use these in a sentence anymore. I'm not going to make you use them on the forums or anywhere else. This one is just a word that I find interesting. I've always liked the word escalate. Do you know what's so awesome about escalate? It's derived from the word escalator. It's derived from a brand name. That's the best. All right? You would assume that the escalator, the moving stairs contraption, the escalator, you would assume that, oh, well, they took the word escalate, meaning raise to the next level, and they made it escalator. And that's what an escalator does. It escalates people. It's a people escalator. Nope. Turns out, no, they were moving stairs. That was the whole point. It was moving stairs. And someone needed a brand name for their moving stairs. And so they got all clever and they went back to Latin and they used different Latin pieces to make the word escalate, which they assumed meant to lift up from these Latin roots. But it was entirely made up. There was no actual escalator or escalate in Latin. But using Latin elements and kind of bending a little bit, they made escalator. Great. Now, escalators have been around so long that we don't even call moving stairs anymore. We call all moving stairs escalators, no matter who created them. All right? We have completely obliterated the brand name and made it a common noun. And then someone said, well, if those are escalators, then clearly to escalate means to raise up to the next level. That's clearly what escalate means. And so that's where we get the word. I love that. I think it's a great origin, an awesome word. And who's ready for a badass movie quote of the week? You are. Okay, this one is from Kill Bill. This is Uma Thurman as the bride. She has just finished completely tearing up the Crazy 88. And this is one of those long, long scenes, much like the end of 13 Assassins, or much like the lobby scene in The Matrix, this is one of those long scenes that just goes on forever, and it is nothing but kick-ass fighting after kick-ass fighting after kick-ass fighting forever. And it's glorious. And when it's all done, and all the Crazy Eight are arrayed about on the floor, and half of them are dead, and half of them are dismembered, and the few remaining are moaning in pain, Uma Thurman, the bride, Beatrice, walks out and says, "Those of you lucky enough to have your lives, take them with you. However, leave the limbs you've lost. They belong to me now." Whoa, see, she would scare me, right? Kill Bill is a great movie, and was that from Kill Bill 1 or Kill Bill 2? Ha! It's not from either. It's just Kill Bill. In my mind, it's always a single 3.5-hour movie. That's the only way to view it, back to back. So let me ask you, did you like Hazy Dixie as much as I do? Probably not, but it doesn't matter because I'm going to give you another song anyway. This one is, and I debated because they have so many good songs. They really, really do. But this one's probably the most fun. This is Queen's Fat Bottom Girls, and they kill it. It is awesome. Here.
Oh, you gonna take me home tonight? Oh, down side that ripper line. Oh, you gonna let it all hang out? Fat bottom girls, you make the rhyme world go round.
Yeah. kitty lad. Never mean no good for bad, but I knew love before I left my nursery. Left alone with Big Fat Fanny, she was such a naughty natty. Hey, big woman, you made a bad boy out of me. Oh, you're gonna take me home tonight. Oh, down beside that red fire line. Oh, you're gonna let it all hang out. That bottom girl, you make the rock and world go round. Yeah, that bottom girl, you make the rock and world go round.
Told you that was cool, wasn't it? All right. Guess what it's time for? The Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble. He rolls up random topics for me to talk about. Where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Then you need to send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to the Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. All right. Before I get to the first Pod-O-Matic entry, let me just say, I repeat it every single episode, usually two or three times. I do it in the Pod-O-Matic. I do it in the credits. I mentioned it other places. I am not kidding. When you come to our forums and you talk, I'm there. I read everything. I talk. All right, you send me email, it could be 3-4 days a week before I get my email. It's not as important to me. I check it all the time, but you know, not so good for communicating with me. You want to talk to me, you show up at the forums, I'm there. I talk. That's the best way to get hold of me. So if you've got some Pod-O-Matic stuff that you want to see done, I mean, they all go in the list. Everybody gets a shot. You'll be on the air. I promise. I get to all of them. So come visit me on the forums. Come submit some Pod-O-Matic stuff. Come just hang out and talk. Honestly, it is a great, great place, great time. Number 41. This one comes from Billy Bob. Billy Bob says, rock, paper, or scissors? Oh, clearly, scissors. That's the opening move is always scissors. And here's the problem with it, is everyone knows that the opening move is always scissors. They know that, so therefore, you really ought to open with rock, all right? But then the problem with that is that everyone knows that all idiots go for rock. That's the way idiots open up, is they open with rock, because when you give rock, paper, scissors as a choice, people always think, oh, well, rock is clearly the strongest, because it just seems that way. And so everyone goes for strength. They go for rock, whereas the smart move would be go for paper, right? Because, you know, idiots are going to go for rock, or newbies are going to go for rock. Let's not even call them idiots at this point. So the newbies always go for rock. So you know you should go for paper, and that's why scissors is the right choice, because rock is strong, paper is passive, scissors is nice middle of the road, and scissors is the safe bet, really. And so that's why you go scissors. Scissors is that middle of the road. You don't want to be strong. You don't want to be weak. You go scissors. The problem is, if you're going up against idiots, they're going to go wind up with rock, right? Idiots are always going to throw rocks. If you go your scissors and you play to the middle, well, then you're going to get smashed. Great. So now really, you ought to go rock, because no one's going to pick paper. That's too passive. Most openers are either going to be rock or they're going to be scissors. Therefore, you got to play it safe and go rock. That's really the only obvious choice, because if you go rock, then you match the noobs. All right, so you at least tie there, and if someone's being clever and using the proper opening move of scissors, well, you've smashed them and you win. So really, rock would be the compromise opening move. But again, now, if you're smart enough to know that, well, now you've got two groups, the people who are smart like us and the newbies, and they're all doing rock. It would really seem that rock would be like the two-thirds choice for openers, wouldn't it? So really, you need to play the odds, and you need to go paper. This is why I can't play rock, paper, scissors. It's because I overthink it. I play rock, paper, scissors against my brother, and I swear to God, he kicks my butt 80% of the time, because he's in my head. He is, I hate it, and I try to get ahead of him. You know, you get, and every now and then, if you're playing rock, paper, scissors in person, that's one thing. Rock, paper, scissors in person, he also tends to beat me most of the time there, but you can get on a run, all right? And you start to realize you're following his pattern, you're following your pattern, and you realize, okay, he's doing this, and when I do this, he responds that way, so I need to get two steps ahead of him, and I need to do that one. Okay, because for a long time, one of the easiest ways to do it was to get in the habit of go 1, 2, 3, go! And on go, whatever you're about to make, you have to mentally switch and go forward 1. And whatever beats whatever you're going to make, because you got to assume that your opponent thinks the way you do, and he's probably going to do the same thing, and so you jump a step ahead. All right, my brother's really, really good at that. And for a while, it used to be we'd play head-to-head, and I could get sometimes where I'd get a run of like 4, 5, 6 in a row where I could see it coming, and I would get on him, but he still gets ahead of me. He still, on average, kicks my butt. And so we played online. There used to be, and maybe still is, there's probably a lot of them now, used to be a rock, paper, scissors site online that you could do where you would submit your move and your opponent's email address, then your opponent would respond, and then it would reveal both of them, and you'd find out who won. And he got so inside my head, he would give me hints. He would tell me what he's going to do, and then I would go to beat it, and then I would realize that I would overthink it, and I'd get too far ahead of myself, and he would be so in my head. He'd know exactly how I was going to follow the chain, and he found out ways that he could tell me his move and then still beat me, because I would be so clever on my own that I would try and get ahead of that, and he would still wind up winning. I hate rock, paper, scissors. I love rock, paper, scissors, but I hate rock, paper, scissors. It is just, it's maddening. For being the simplest game in the world, the simplest head-to-head competition you can possibly come up with, it just drives me bats that I lose as much as I do. Ugh! Thank you, R2. I thought you were going to leave me in that hell forever. We've moved on to number 68. This one comes from Brasky. Brasky says, you can pick your live backup band to play behind you while you sing karaoke. Who do you pick? All right. Then he continues, okay, other than They Might Be Giants, who else do you pick? Now, actually, to tell you the truth, I would actually, I have two possible answers for this one. The first is the cop-out answer where I pick someone really, really famous because I don't really care if they play my backup or not. I just want to meet them. But in all honesty, I really think right this moment, I just listened to Hayseed Dixie. I've been listening to their music all week. I can't get that stuff out of my head. So I would actually pick them because that's fun. Everything they play is fun. Even when it's a slow, depressing song, well, bluegrass music is going to be hopped up, hyperspeed, and fun to listen to. And I think that would be a lot of fun to sing to. I would love to go up for karaoke and give people familiar songs. Give them songs that they all know. They all know the words to. But it's kicked up in bluegrass. How much fun would that be? Number 23. This one is Serious Paul again. Michael Keaton versus Michael Caine. Who do you like in the movies? Well, I like both of them. I got no problem with either one of them. If I had to pick one over the other, I would probably say Michael Caine is the better actor. But I like watching Michael Keaton more. I don't know why. I've always enjoyed Michael Keaton in movies. He's just a decent, likable guy, and he does well. He does good in comedy. He does good in serious roles. I enjoy his work. What can I say? Michael Caine, on the other hand, while I think Michael Caine is an excellent actor, I really do, top notch. Michael Caine also never turns down a paycheck, from what I can tell. Michael Caine has made so many horrible movies. And not that Michael Keaton hasn't made horrible movies, but Michael Caine has done so many really bad movies where clearly he's just there phoning in to get a paycheck. A great actor, but, you know, he likes his money. So not that I can knock him for that. I would be more than happy to sell out if it meant living the comfortable life that he lives. But, you know, Michael Keaton, I just like more. And interesting fact about Michael Keaton. His birth name, Michael Douglas. Why did he change it to Keaton? Well, because there's already a Michael Douglas, isn't there? Yeah, and he's even Kirk Douglas's son. How are you going to compete with that? So he switched to Michael Keaton after silent film star Buster Keaton. There you go. Number 24. This one is also from Serious Paul, because it's right here next to the last one. And it says, oh, I was afraid this was going to come up. Did you like Blade Runner? I don't know how to answer this one. This is one of my shameful secrets. Is seriously, I don't like Blade Runner. I don't know what to tell you. I get it. It's a good movie. I get that it is, supposedly. I understand why people loved it. I understand it's a great premise. It is a great story, and yet the film does not thrill me. I saw it first when I was in high school, and I was mostly bored. And then I've watched it since because it's been on Instant Watch. It's been available to me. I've watched it since then thinking, you know what? I just didn't give it a fair shake in high school. I need to watch it now. And it turns out maybe I'm spoiled by modern blockbuster movies. But the slow pace, oh, it was like pulling teeth, for goodness sake. It just, that thing drags on. And as much as I like the story, I like it a lot, and I think the actors are spectacular. I have no problem with that. The sets are real and gritty and fun, and it's got Rutger Hauer, for God's sake. How can you not like something with Rutger Hauer? And there's so many good things, and yet the pacing was just so bad. It just wants to put me to sleep. So this is my secret shame, and I say secret shame because I've used Blade Runner as the example of good science fiction. I've used that as an example in my work. You make references to it, and because you get, anytime you say Blade Runner, you get instant recognition, instant geek recognition, knowing that this is a good piece of work that everyone is familiar with and everybody likes, don't they? Well, sadly, I don't. So I feel terrible. I feel ashamed. So people say, they're talking about remaking Blade Runner. I don't know if they're talking about remaking it now, but they have in the past. And they're talking about remaking Blade Runner, and oh, what a horrible idea. And oh, what, I'm like, no, please remake Blade Runner. Please update this thing to reflect modern technology. And for God's sake, give it to a director who can actually bring some action to it, who can actually step up this pace a little bit, who can entertain me, because I have ADD and I need to be constantly pandered to. So please, remake Blade Runner and pander to me. It's what I want. So what about 13? 13? From Brasky. Remember when MTV used to show videos? As an old man, I like to complain about how they don't. Even Beavis and Butthead are coming back, but we'll comment on reality shows like Jersey Shore instead of music videos. But there's still a ton of videos out there, but just accessed through YouTube and other interweb services. Is this worse or better? Am I just an old fuddy-duddy who like to watch back-to-back videos on my television? I don't care. This is a topic that I also have many times said, wow, remember when MTV used to show music? Remember when music television involved music in some way? Remember when their early game shows and non-video programming actually had something to do with music because they felt like it had to be related? Yeah. And now at this point, I realize it's a lost cause because, they had MTV, they had VH1. Country music television still shows videos. They still show country music in between showing country-themed related movies and God knows what else they put on that thing. And then there's MTV2 where you might get some music videos. You know when MTV shows music videos? 2 a.m. VH1, in fact, when my wife was last in labor. Maybe it was the time before that. I don't remember. Anyway, we were at the hospital overnight. And let me tell you that from 1 a.m. until 5 a.m, VH1 is nonstop music videos. Although, it's nonstop the same 20 videos repeated over and over in a cycle. Oh, my God. You know what? Let me tell you. Because of that night, I cannot listen to freaking Daniel Powder song, Bad Day, because my wife is in labor for hours overnight. When I say hours, this was a long labor for her. It was like 6 hours. But my wife is in labor all night long, and Bad Day. So you had a bad day. I got into my brain. And you would think, why didn't we change the channel? Well, you know what? We had other things to think about. And that was just, it was background noise, but that song over and over and over. And there were 20 songs that repeated. And every now and then one of them will come up, and I'm like, oh, my God, that's one of those. I remember. But it's just like a little flashback. But it's not that grinding, soul-crushing Daniel Powder. Oh, how I hate him. Did I get off topic? Am I? You know what? Clearly, showing music videos during primetime or daytime hours is simply not profitable. It's just not. No one's going to pay to put their advertisements in between music videos when there's other things that will actively seek to reach out of the screen and entertain the hell out of you rather than letting you listen to music and watch your videos. So, sadly, it just ain't going to come back, at least not in any profitable way. But you know, I don't mind. My wife watches tons of music videos on YouTube. It's how she, you know, like I said, she follows the charts. She sees what stars are up and coming, what songs are hitting the charts, things like that. And any song that comes up, she goes over to YouTube and watches the video for it, because that's just the easiest way to get a free sample of the song. If you want to hear the whole song beginning to end, you go search for it on YouTube. You get to listen to it. The ones we like, we buy off of iTunes. The ones we don't, we don't. And sometimes the music videos are really, 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 really entertaining. And sometimes, yeah, they're not. Doesn't make any difference to me. We're just there listening for the music. So, you know, personally, I like it. I mean, yes, there's something nostalgic about it, and I miss the days of just vegging in front of some music videos, or working on homework or doing something else while the videos are on in the background. Great background music to have that entertainment. So if you wanted to watch, you could, but you didn't have to. I miss it, but yeah, not that much. Number 62. This one is from a Mr. Jeff Hawes. Welcome back, Jeff. Jeff says, do you join the Breakfast Club, Ferris Bueller, or the crew who hung out at San Elmo's bar? All right, first off, I don't even like going to bars. And the people at St. Elmo's were a bunch of whiny, whiny brats. I couldn't stand that movie. I hated them. I hated their movie. I don't want to go anywhere near St. Elmo's. It was terrible. All right, now, having said that, the kids in Breakfast Club are also a bunch of whiny, whiny brats. But I think they might have been fun to hang out with for that Saturday afternoon. I mean, I don't want to be in detention any more than anyone else, but that, you know, it was entertaining. I would have enjoyed that conversation. I would have enjoyed breaking down and explaining how the flare gun went off in my locker. I get that. But really, I mean, is there any choice? Come on, you got to go to Ferris Bueller. Ferris Bueller, now, granted, if Ferris Bueller were my friend, he would not have convinced me to come out of the house, because I wouldn't have been staying home sick in the first place. I would have been at school, and he wouldn't have gotten me out of school, because I'm such a goody-goody and I'm afraid of my own shadow. So I never would have done it. But man, if I could have, what a great day they had. And Ferris Bueller is a party and a half. Every single bit of that was perfect. And you're hanging out with Ferris Bueller, so as long as you don't wreck your dad's car, everything's golden. Nothing sticks to this man. So much fun to be had. Number 69. This is from Stan. Stan says, should we make It Gets Better PSAs for nerds? Oh, so should we have public service announcements to tell nerds that really life isn't always going to be like this? That really one day, all right, you know, I don't know. Should we have PSAs for anti-nerd bullying? I mean, we already have the anti-bullying stuff. I don't know. It's hard to say, because a lot of PSAs, I think, to tell nerds that, you know what, life's going to get better, you know, that high school isn't really the end-all be-all of everything, that honestly you're going to get 5 years down the road and realize that none of that made any difference at all. Yeah, but I think the problem with PSAs like that is they honestly just give people more fodder with which to make fun of nerds. I mean, honestly, you think this is your brain on drugs? You think that didn't live on forever? You know, you get some PSAs that are highlighting nerds and highlighting nerds getting picked on. Yeah, it's just gonna be more trouble than it's worth. PSAs like that rarely provide the benefit that we really hope they would. I mean, because seriously, this is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. All right, we still do that one. You know what my favorite PSA from the old days is? Yeah, from you. All right, I learned it by watching you. All right, and I know you all know that one. And that just kills me. That fits into so many situations nowadays. And did the ad itself have any impact? Did it change anything, anyone's behavior? I doubt it. I don't know. But man, isn't it great to look back 20 years, 25 years, and be able to use that line and know everyone's in on the joke with you? That thing's great. Number 39. From Brasky again. Brasky says, what type of musical instrument do you wish you could master? Oh, this one's easy. Banjo. Right? And not because of the whole Hayseed Dixie bluegrass thing today. I've always said that. I love the banjo. I don't know what it is about the banjo. To me, it is this magical instrument. It is this amazing thing. I wish I could master it. I wish I could learn to play the banjo, and I wish I could learn to be good at it. Now, this isn't like me saying I wish I could be a cheese nerd, where to become a cheese nerd, all I have to do is, you know, spend $5 a week to go down and pick up some different cheese and try it. all right, this would actually require me buying a banjo, which is pricey, and it would require me spending the time to take lessons and to practice, you know, and I would have to practice at length on a daily basis in order to get good at it. And it's probably not something I'm going to do. In fact, I know that's not something I'm going to do because that kind of money and that kind of time are just not on my agenda right now. I got four kids, people, and I got this podcast. Would you guys want me to give up the podcast just to go learn banjo? I mean, yeah, I'd come back eventually, but I'd miss you. So maybe someday. It's still a dream of mine. I don't want to say it's on my bucket list because I hate saying bucket list, but it is one of those things that, yeah, you know what? When the kids get a little bit older, when I'm not spending so much time taking care of them and having to do all the stuff that goes along with this busy family routine, I might take banjo lessons. I might figure out some. I might try it because I love the banjo. It's my favorite instrument of all time. Number 50. No, I'm sorry. I'm reading backwards. 25. This one from Billy Bob. And Billy Bob says, best fantasy mount. Well, clearly Jessica Alba. No. Sorry. I apologize. That was terrible. That was terrible. I am so sorry. No. Best fantasy. See, now I can't even keep a straight face. Best fantasy mount. Pecacorns. No, that's also not right. All right. Here's the deal. Speaking in fantasy games, I love riding dogs. When D&D 3 came out with the concept of riding dogs for halflings and gnomes, I just think that's the coolest thing. I love riding dogs. I love the idea of getting yourself, a lab or a whatever it is, and your halfling just mounts that sucker up, get a saddle on your dog, and bam, off you go. Just like the Taco Bell monkey. Is that the dude? All right. Taco John's monkey. I can't remember where the monkey comes from. Anyway, but that's not the real answer, because we're talking about the best fantasy mount for me. As much as I would love to be a gnome riding a dog in my D&D game, we're talking about a real fantasy mount. I'm going to have to go griffin, man. How badass is a griffin? All right, and riding a griffin, a lion does not have a real steady riding gait. They're not, they don't have the long galloping stride of the horses and all this, but a sucker flies, so who gives a crap, right? All right, and it's a freaking griffin. Oh, my God. Lion muscles, lion claws, this big beak on the front, all right, this huge 20-foot wingspan, this terror from the sky. All right, if I saw a griffin in any context whatsoever, I would pee myself. All right, and now imagine that you're on its back, probably wielding a badass sword. All right, griffin, hands down, griffin. In fact, a griffin as a mount is so cool, I would probably never let any character in any of my games ever have one because it's too cool for anyone to have by themselves, ever. 65. This one, ooh, Talvin. Hi, Talvin. Talvin says, kiss, marry, kill. I love this one. All right. Talvin gives me Nathan Fillion, Will Wheaton, and Neil Patrick Harris. Okay. Now, Talvin, is this not the exact same combination that we gave to Felicia Day when she was on the Animal Cast? Did we not ask her this exact same question? All right. Either way, it's actually pretty simple. By the way, that was the best part of the podcast when we did the interview with Felicia Day. This is on a different podcast. Sorry to keep bringing up the past, but we did an interview with Felicia Day, and anytime we did an interview on our show, and we did maybe a dozen of them, anytime we did an interview, we always ended it with an F Mary Kill, which is now sanitized to the Kiss Mary Kill for this show. We always ended it with an F Mary Kill, and when we had Felicia Day on, she was like the biggest star we had ever had. I mean, everyone else is game designers and stuff like this, but Felicia Day, who is a nerd icon, agreed to be on our show. Holy crap. And we're like, so do we really end it with an F Mary Kill? We're like, well, we have to. I mean, our fans would think we were copping out if we toned it down just because Felicia Day's here. And so we asked her, and she was a great sport. She was awesome about it. And I can't remember who we put on the list. I'm pretty sure this may be the exact same question. Nathan Fillion, Will Wheaton, Neil Patrick Harris. But anyway, She was great about it. So, how would I answer it? Yeah, for me, this one is simple. I don't even have to think about this one. First off, I kill Will Wheaton. He's overrated. I mean, hey, look, I love Will Wheaton as much as the next nerd, but yeah, he's overrated. And he's no Nathan Fillion. For goodness sake, Nathan Fillion would be my wild night of snogging. Definitely be kissing Nathan Fillion. That man is a stud muffin. Holy cow. But just the other night, I was watching Castle, and Nathan's gotten a little beefy. I mean, he's kind of bulked up a little bit. Just I'm not that he isn't still dreamy. I absolutely love Nathan Fillion, and he is still my choice for my wild night of passionate snogging. But you know, to make up for the episode of Castle, I mean, it was not 2 days before that I was watching him in Firefly, in the episode where Christina Hendricks strands him out in the desert naked, sitting on a crate, and that was awesome because one, there's Nathan Fillion there naked for my wife. And two, Christina Hendricks was in that episode. And Christina Hendricks, before Mad Men, this was where I knew her from, was two episodes of Firefly where she shows up. And in those episodes of Firefly, Christina Hendricks was a knockout. Holy crap. I mean, yes, and look, on Mad Men, she looks great. I've never actually watched the show, but she looks great now. She is a fabulous, sexy, gorgeous woman. But on those two episodes of Firefly, like I say, this is where I was introduced to her, was Firefly, and just unreal. Just fabulous. Like fabulous enough that I didn't even care about Kaylee for the episode. Wow! But then it turns out she's evil, so, you know, good thing we got rid of her, right? Oh, I'm sorry. Was I in the middle of a question? That's right. Okay, so I killed Will Wheaton already. I made out with Nathan Fillion. Well, that clearly leaves me with just Neil Patrick Harris to marry, and I think I've already married him in another Kiss, Marry, Kill, because Neil Patrick Harris would just be awesome to spend the rest of my life with. One, he's rich. Two, he's fascinating. The guy would be great conversation. He would do lots of fun things, and he's got the money to support me in the lifestyle to which I've become accustomed, or would like to become accustomed. This is a win-win for everybody. Well, maybe not for him. No, it's a win-win for him, too, because he gets me, and that's all that matters. And holy crap, that was the last one. So, this podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. The featured music this week was Hacey Dixie with Centerfold and Fat Bottom Girls. The opening and closing theme is from the Beastie Boys Sabotage, as performed by the Penelopes. The bumper clips are taken from She Blinded Me with Science by Will Shatner, Weezer's In the Garage, Wonderful World by Sam Cooke, and Words by Missing Persons. All bumper music is available on iTunes. Check them out. Buy them. I would not put them in my show if I didn't love them, and I mean that. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes. Write us a nice review. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But as I said before, and I will reiterate here, the very best way to contact me is by coming over to our forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up for an account. Send me a private message. Hang out and chat on the forum. We'll hang out together and have fun. And it comes from Sirius Paul, no surprise. Sirius Paul says, if you could graft any two animals together, what would they be? And then after the owl and bear, then what would they be? Oh, all right. Owl bear would be super cool. I will give you that one. But after making myself an owl bear, I would probably go with a unicorn and a pegasus. And I would create a creature that I like to call a unisys. And then I would lead it quietly out to a field and smother it.